On the legal end of things, we're joined by Camille Panu. She teaches law at UC Davis, where she directs the Water Justice Clinic. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And from Washington, we have John Nichols. He's National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine. Good morning to you, John.
It's a pleasure to be with you all.
Camille, I want to start with you on the legal end of things. The shorthand in most media reports is Anthony Kennedy. Is this swing justice? What did he represent politically? What would a more conservative replacement represent in terms of jurisprudence?
So I think it's important to remember that the court as a whole has been tacking toward the right. Most of the folks who've been appointed in recent history or who've been serving have been appointed by fairly conservative legislatures and presidents who had picked a fairly activist bent on what a conservative court could do. So as you noted, Brian, as the court moved right, Anthony Kennedy, who's a solid conservative, I would say, moderate, but a solid conservative, became increasingly important when it came to things like the role of human dignity in the law and also the relationship between courts, the federal government, and the state with respect to citizens. And so Kennedy is most known for having a bit of a libertarian streak and having a bit of a human dignity streak. I don't want to overplay those things because there are certainly cases in which he was not as, welcoming or encompassing as his cases that he's most well known for example, the gay rights cases. But for the court, this is, speaking as an advocate, this is a little terrifying for me. The court has tacked pretty far to the right. Justices Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas are all fairly conservative activists. Justice Roberts is an activist. And so I think we're going to see a lot of dismantling of what used to be pretty well-settled Supreme Court precedent in the coming years.
John Nichols, what kind of nominee should we expect out of President Trump?
Well, I think coming off what was just said, which is a very wise comment, sir, but that key word, activist, the truth of the matter is Kennedy was not an activist on most issues. Kennedy was someone who, when the issues came his way, he dealt with them. And generally, that put him on the right. He was a very conservative justice. And yet, he did have this soft libertarian streak that surfaced in a few places. But again, issue after issue, he was someone who was confronting the case that came before him, usually looking for a conservative solution, sometimes going toward the middle. The next nominee, the person who will be chosen to replace him, will be an activist. And what we've learned from Donald Trump's approach to judicial nominations, and remember, we now have a lot of information on this. He has picked one Supreme Court nominee, but dozens and dozens of people put forward and proposed for lower courts. And the folks that he puts forward are people who have been vetted by the most activist conservative groupings. And so his nominee to replace Justice Kennedy will be someone who will go, if they make it through the process, who will go to the court with an agenda. That agenda will first and foremost be the advancement of social conservative agenda items or positions. And the reason for that is that Donald Trump is terrified of the social right, the religious right. He's played to them. And when I say terrified, it doesn't mean he wakes up in horror every night. What I would say is he can't get on the wrong side of that group of folks, because when you look at his polling, that's who sustains him. That's his base. And so he will deliver for them. But parallel to that, and our media almost never covers this element of it as well as they should, whoever he nominates will be an extreme and in many ways perhaps more activist individual on corporate issues. So that's a sum up of it. There are some people whose names have been put forward. I think in fairness, that's very speculative at this point. But the bottom line is, you're not going to get a surprise here. You're not going to get somebody who is, has an eccentric or interesting record. You will have someone who is absolutely seen as, quote-unquote, reliable by the religious right and by corporate interests.
John, can you talk a little bit more about the corporatist agenda that you would see coming up to the court with a new Trump appointee?
Absolutely. Well, we saw it writ large yesterday, didn't we, in the Janus case. And when I was writing about this yesterday, I merged the two together for a reason. I think the Janus case was one that people were expecting to come. They weren't surprised. Janus is a case out of Illinois which really deconstructs a lot of the traditional protections for labor unions. And it systematized how you collect dues and basically how government entities relate to public sector unions. What the court has said is that now, as someone who's represented by a union, who gets the benefits of collective bargaining and representation in the workplace, you don't have to pay any dues unless you opt in to do it. You literally go and say, hey, I want to fill this form out and give you money. Now, what's going to happen in that situation? This is structural stuff. What's going to happen in that situation is a lot of people who actually, you know, value the union and are, you know, basically pro-union won't pay their dues. It isn't that they don't like the union. It's that that's just putting money on the table that they will not be inclined to do. We know this from a lot of history. So what the court has done is created a structural reality designed to undermine unions. And that's the way to understand this corporate agenda. On issue after issue, they're not, you know, kind of in the lofty heights of legal theory, jurisprudence. They're down and dirty. They're looking at how do you take the steps that will weaken those interests that represent consumers, folks who are harmed by corporate irresponsibility, labor unions, communities, you know, everybody who may want to push back on a corporate agenda, or frankly, to push for the commons, for the public sector, for the public sphere. We have seen over the last 10 years in the states a very rigid anti-union agenda, but also a very rigid anti-public sector, public sphere agenda. Now you're going to see that come to the court in an even more advanced way. Janus is an example, 5-4 decision, bad decision. Trump will appoint someone who is likely to, at the very least, give us more decisions of that kind.
Camille Panu, what kind of cases are in the pipeline where this seat might be decisive?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm not sure that I can answer that really well at the moment, but, you know, we have a couple of cases that people are nervous about coming up. So we have a number of immigration cases that are currently pending with the crisis and the kind of extremely cruel and torturous policies that are being enacted. We have a lot kind of coming through the pipeline also on, you know, women's rights and reproductive rights, of which Justice Kennedy was not necessarily he was pretty comfortable, I guess I would say, with limiting women's reproductive rights in some core ways. And there's a great deal of fear that there'll be more test cases coming up on civil rights issues in particular. You know, but John was really wise to point out the corporate element of it because, of course, as we know, Kennedy also wrote Citizens United. And so the current court, I think more than, you know, just labeling it as conservative or liberal, has a really pro-business kind of grouping of conservative justices who believe in this notion of like kind of a laissez-faire economy of speech. And so I think we're going to see a lot of interesting cases come through where the court essentially doesn't side with people who are in less powerful positions. Even if the law is on their side, they're going to be siding with what they think is a free market, pretending that a corporation has the same amount of power as, you know, a line employee who's on their own trying to resist policies or trying to advance policies that support their ability to work.
Free speech is really interesting. Over the past couple of sessions, it has really evolved into a club that has been wielded against everything from LGBT rights to the power of unions. A lot of people are now calling this the weaponization of free speech. How far do you think that could go? I mean, could this same line of argument be used to dismantle basic welfare state programs? Could it go after Medicaid or Social Security?
I would be surprised to see it go that far, just because those programs are run through a different part of the Constitution than free speech. But I think where you will see it begin to imperil resources, and we saw this even when Justice Kennedy was on the court, or he currently is on the court, but we saw this during his tenure, is that you're seeing in a large number of cases coming up with this kind of convoluted reasoning that I have a First Amendment right to my religious practice, and I have a right to then impose that on you in public facilities and public, the delivery of public services. For the most part, Kennedy was not fully on board with that. If you were a state actor and you were kind of touting that sort of thing, he wasn't very impressed. If you were an individual, he was a little bit more sensitive to the specific facts of your case and the particularities. I think Masterpiece Cake Shop is a good example of that. I would be really shocked, though, if people were able to effectively use the First Amendment to dismantle the welfare state. I think what's more likely is that it'll be death by a thousand paper cuts, and there'll be a bunch of exemptions that are trying to come through that justify limiting the delivery of services. I think Hobby Lobby is a really great example of how that was used to essentially undermine the provision of comprehensive insurance to workers.
Hobby Lobby was the decision that let quote-unquote closely held private corporations choose not to offer birth control through their medical plans because of religious beliefs.
Exactly.
Camille, what about the landmark climate legislation, Massachusetts v. EPA? What might the future be for our climate, key climate cases and other environmental cases?
Well, I think, you know, so I'm a practicing environmental lawyer most of the time, and I think there's a great deal of concern about what's going to be happening going forward. One of the things that Justice Kennedy brought to the table is that for the longest time, he was the only justice from the West. So for the most part, now we have Justice Gorsuch, but before him, almost everyone was from the East Coast. They were primarily from east of the Mississippi. I think Justice Stevens was the only one who was quote-unquote Western. He's from Chicago. And so what that changes is how we look at environment. So, for example, Justice Kennedy wrote a plurality opinion called Rapinos, which is about how water is treated under federal law. But he also wrote Core Alaska, which allowed mining companies to essentially dump slurry in a lake. And his reasoning for getting there was really bizarre, to be honest, allowed people to essentially dump mercury and other poisonous materials into a lake that was used for other resources and other people. On climate legislation and climate cases, I think the important part about Massachusetts v. EPA was that it created an area of standing for states to be able to contest environmental issues that were affecting their state in profound and negative ways. In Massachusetts v. EPA, it was the shoreline and the impact of kind of sea level rise. But he also kind of came down very clearly on what the science was. And there's been a pretty big effort under this administration to undermine well-established science and research and to argue that somehow facts or observable data is a political battle, not a matter of a scientific process. And it'll be interesting to see how the court comes down on that. The current justices are not very friendly, I would say, to federal regulation or, frankly, even to state regulation of environmental issues.
Don Nichols, everything I've seen coming out of the Senate Democratic Caucus so far is they're adopting the line Mitch McConnell did 2 years ago, which is that this seat should not be filled before the class of incoming senators from the 2018 midterm election is sworn in. What are the realistic prospects for Democrats blocking?
Well, first off, I'm glad you use the word realistic, because here's where the problem comes in. When Mitch McConnell advanced that absurd construct 2 years ago, not for the purpose of having serious deliberations, but because he wanted to prevent Barack Obama from making an appointment of a very moderate nominee, in this case Merrick Garland, to replace a right-wing judicial activist, Antonin Scalia. And, you know, you will see the Democrats suggest it. And frankly, from a quid pro quo standpoint, it makes sense. If the Republican leadership of the Senate has said that you shouldn't fill judicial vacancies when a branch of government, one of the three branches, is up for grabs. And they said that in 2016 because the presidency was up for grabs. Now we have the Senate up for grabs on the legislative branch. Yeah, it makes, you know, it's just, if you're going to play that game, well, then you go forward. Here's where the problem comes in. Mitch McConnell had a majority. Mitch McConnell also had the key committee chair. So once you have that, you can stop the process. You have, unless there's a big break within your majority coalition. The Democrats don't have that. They don't have a majority in the Senate. They don't have the committee chair. As a result, it's hard to put that approach into place. I think the Democrats will largely oppose. And I think that some of them will oppose very aggressively and as effectively as they can. However, you have a number of Democrats in what are referred to as red states, Trump voting states, who are up for re-election this year. And if even a handful of them break, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, as examples, then the concept that the Democrats could hold firm with their base of senators and then get a Republican, a couple of Republicans to come over. Remember, John McCain is very sick and as a result might not be present for a vote. That then makes it, you know, a little bit easier to find one or two Republicans who might go along in a particular case. But if the Democrats cannot hold their caucus together on that, then this becomes very hard. And so we have to be, as you suggested, realistic. If we are realistic on this thing, this is going to be a tough game. And it's a tough game not because of, you know, the particular partisan breakdown here, but because Mitch McConnell has signaled that he will use the rules and restructure the rules to achieve the end that he seeks. And, you know, he has the upper hand at this point, so we shouldn't be dishonest about it.
Are there points of pressure? I'm sure listeners are deeply concerned about the length of time of impact that a new, you know, deeply conservative justice obviously could have on an already deeply conservative court. Mm-hmm. Are there points of impact that people can engage in now to try and have their voice heard, to, you know, hope to potentially shift this appointment from happening, or supporting a Democratic push to try and at least hold it off?
Absolutely. And that's the most important message here. Brian's good question was about, you know, inside the Senate, do Democrats hold and what are their strategic moves? To my mind, this is one of those places where, of course, you call out the parliamentarians, right? You call out every expert on the rules, and Democrats look for every way to slow this process down. But what is the heart and soul of this is the great mass of Americans. And so mobilizing people, you know, making this a central issue, especially in an election year, is a very good idea. It's not, you know, just a feel-good thing. It also has political potential. And so what I always say to people is, don't look for new issues to be worried about. Look for your heart and soul issues. If you care about the environment, we've just heard some very, very good counsel on concerns as regards the environment. If you care about corporate power, if you care about the right to choose, if you care about LGBTQ rights, you know, you just run down this list of important issues. And frankly, if you care about separation of powers, i.e., will there be any checking and balancing, not just of President Trump, but of a imperial presidency in general, you know, follow through with the groups that you have historically been engaged with. They're all going to be active in this. The National Organization for Women has, you know, literally declared pretty close to a state of emergency. You know, look, this is, you know, really the point at which critical issues, especially reproductive rights issues, come into play. Go work with that. If you're, again, concerned about environmental issues, go and work with that. You're going to find groups that are highly engaged. Make enough noise so that then there are people in the Senate, both wavering Democrats and wavering Republicans, and remember there are several, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, who have broken on major issues. That's why the Affordable Care Act is still in place, for instance. But there has got to be a mass mobilization. This has to be something huge that exists beyond Washington if there's going to be any possibility of, you know, kind of getting a couple of Republicans to come over and say, maybe not even to say stop this nomination, maybe to simply say, let's not rush this thing.
All right. John Nichols, that's all the time we have. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation. We also had with us Camille Panu. She teaches law at UC Davis, where she directs the Water Justice Clinic. Thank you to you, Camille.
Thanks so much.